You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Saturday, November 29th, 2014, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Yeah. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Evan Bernstein.
Hi.
And special guest rogue, George Krob. Welcome, George. So we are recording the show on November 29th, but this is going to be going up on December 20th, which will be a few weeks from now because we already have a couple of shows in the can, as they say. So we are doing a live show in front of an elite studio audience.
Good-looking audience.
Yeah, very good-looking audience.
Very.
You're right.
December 20th.
Apparently today, December 20th, in the year our Lord 1900, the journal Nature published an article that William
Dubois. Is it Dubois?
Well, he's probably English. He is English.
Oh, okay.
That was the next
Dubois?
Phrase that Dubois? I wrote down.
Dubois.
Dubois is how you pronounce it.
Dubois.
Apparently, you're not familiar with the English habit of changing every French word to sound ridiculous. But, yeah, generally in English, it would be Du Bois. Anyway, let's go with William Duddell. he was a physicist, and he, created sounds, musical notes using electric currents produced by an arc lamp. And he could alter the currents to produce any pitch that he wanted.
So like a theremin?
No.
No.
No, he actually had to touch it, I think, to, okay. I mean, the theremin is, don't giggle. Don't giggle.
You said the word touch.
Just because we're talking about delicately touching instruments. it would produce, anything from a low hum to a high-pitched whistle. Apparently. And so, how is that funny? That's not funny.
The low hum or high
clearly the studio, the studio audience just has a filthy mind and believes it.
More wine.
I know exactly where you went with that.
But this was the, apparently the first recorded case of an electrical instrument. Did you know that, George?
I did not. It was the Hummer phone. Yeah, it was called. No, this sounds a lot like a Tesla coil. Mm. You ever see the when they play Tesla coils?
Yes.
So they hook them up, and you can get the certain arc tones to be produced from a Tesla coil, and it's amazing how sort of how much it sounds just like a cool synth, like this massive synthesizer. So yeah. So what year is this? This
1900.
Is 1900. 'Cause there's an instrument called an Ohms-Martineau, which is the first electronic keyboard instrument. Which there were symphonies written for this thing. I guess this predates that probably by a year or something.
Oh.
So that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
What's the instrument called? Does it have a name?
I don't know that it had a name, actually.
Okay.
It was just the thing that William Duddell...
Arc what?
An arc lamp.
Arc lamp.
Yeah, it was an arc lamp.
Cool.
Yeah.
But an arc lamp's an arc lamp, though.
Yeah.
It's not an instrument.
And he found that adding resonance circuits adjusted the pitch of the sounds, apparently.
So he's making sounds
here
from
we go.
Lamp.
I found a capitalized phrase. His singing arc.
Singing arc.
Yep.
Singing arc. For a time, arc lamps, if I recall correctly, were the brightest lamp that we could produce.
Yeah.
They were the searchlight lights. Before that, it was limelight.
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 They used to light stages, which is where the phrase in the limelight comes from. And then halogen.
It was a candle.
Yeah,
it was. One candle.
Right.
Yeah. Those early synths actually it's quite amazing sort of the experimentation that was happening. There was a French school, they were called Les Six, and they were these composers in the teens and 20s, and they were experimenting with all kinds of like things that you could get on it's not even a 99 cent app. I mean, the cheapest of crappiest keyboards have these sounds now. But at the time, it was fascinating to have like echo on a piano sound where you could just, you didn't have to physically be in a room to have it go, gung, 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 gung. This was an electronic modified signal, and they would compose these pieces that today are just the most boring pieces of shit ever. But because to us we're just so inured to them. But at the time, this was like groundbreaking stuff. So like you'd have this arc lamp, you would have the Owens Martin. No.
So Bertrand Russell. Everyone know Bertrand Russell?
Yeah, of course. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I just read a great graphic novel called Logicomics that is a history of Bertrand Russell's life in comic form.
Yeah. So apparently, yep. Bertrand Russell had his Ten Commandments, which were like Ten Commandments of Reason, as opposed to Ten Commandments of Arbitrary Primitive Sheepherder Rules or whatever.
There's an angry
1951.
Email.
1951. Oh, I resent that.
1951, Bertrand Russell came up with these Ten Commandments, and I had never heard of these particular ones, and they just caught my eye. I thought we'd share them with you, maybe comment as they go. I don't know if they're in reverse order or what, but I'm just going to read them 1 through 10. So here's number 1. Do not feel absolutely certain of anything.
Great rule. About that?
I mean, was he
certain?
Like, yeah. I think it's number 1.
I beat you to
it. You got me, Timmy.
It might not be number 1. number 2, do not think it worthwhile to proceed by concealing evidence, for the evidence is sure to come to light. Good rule. Never try to discourage thinking, for you are sure to succeed.
That's a good one. Okay.
That should be like on That's every nice. Teacher's Ooh. Blackboard.
Right.
You know, every shit
wow,
teacher you
I
ever
like
had.
That.
4, when you meet with opposition, even if it should be from your husband or your children, endeavor to overcome it by argument and not by authority. For a victory dependent upon authority is unreal and illusory. I'm not sure why he only mentioned the husband and not the thing, but whatever.
Love I'm not sure why those say. Were the only two options.
Know,
maybe
yeah.
you can solve it just by being like, let's watch Netflix.
It is 1951, so I guess, yeah, some leeway. Number 5, have no respect for the authority of others, for there are always contrary authorities to be found.
Yeah. It's good. It's a tricky one, though. I mean, just yes. pause for a moment on that one. The authority issue always is tricky, right? The argument from authority, very context-dependent. What we mean by that is that authority itself is no guarantee of being correct. And it's not something upon which you should rest any argument. However, there's having respect for appropriate expertise is fine. It's reasonable.
Right.
You know, the consensus of scientific opinion.
Consensus, yeah.
You know. So I think people have a hard time with that one because you could use that to be a contrarian, right? You could use that to reject anything you don't like, because everything is ultimately based upon authority.
But in a way, that's true of every tenet of skepticism, so to speak, where when you take it to its extreme, it becomes hyper-skepticism and useless.
Right. Everything is context-dependent and requires judgment, right? They're rules of thumb, but you can't... Yeah, that's why it's almost kind of hard to codify them as commandments.
We could sharpen that one to say more of just always have your baloney detector up and running. Right? So, you know, so with any source of authority, just make sure that you're keeping your intellect in baloney. Right.
But I think, if you look at the second part of it, though, it says, for there are always contrary authorities to be found. I think it's maybe not so much saying that, you know, don't just blanketly not respect authority, but if you use authority, be aware that someone arguing with you will have their own experts, which then will have their own opinions.
Which we know is true.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you need to not just have that argument from authority, but also be able to sort of back it up. I think the second part is almost as important. Number 6, do not use power to suppress opinions you think pernicious. For if you do, the opinions will suppress you. So, yeah, untasteful things, sometimes you have to accept them because of the evidence. Number 7, do not fear to be eccentric in opinion, for every opinion now accepted was once eccentric. That's another one.
That's another one.
Like,
it's kind of hard to boil it down.
He thought Einstein would... No, they didn't.
No. That's the Galileo Gambit.
Galileo.
Yeah, so the extreme version of that is the Galileo Gambit, which was funny because, like, we, over the years, you know, we're going to attract some crank emails, right? There was one year leading up to... You remember this? Like, leading up to 2000, there was that guy... This is just before the podcast. This is just based upon the New England Skeptical Society. Who, like, we would get this weekly email from this guy's like, I outperform Einstein and blah, blah, blah. And he was predicting the end.
Outperform Einstein?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's a direct.
Sexually. And he was making these predictions about 2000.
That was 2000. The arc keyboard thing.
That was the Y2K thing. And then when nothing happened on Y2K, I emailed the back. So what happened? I didn't respond for some reason.
He still outperformed Einstein, who had not a thing to say about
Y2K. That's true.
I think this, the seventh one, which, George, can you read 7 again? I have a point to add to that.
Do not fear to be eccentric in opinion, for every opinion now accepted was once eccentric.
I mean, I can interpret that with it being very useful. You know, don't, you know, eccentric, thinking out of the box, non-conventional, that's all good stuff. And he is saying that, you know, things that we believe today that are common knowledge today at one point were avant-garde.
Right.
Right.
Right. But
that's essentially what he's saying.
You have to understand, Bertrand Russell didn't live during the internet when every dumb response was just beaten over your head, like the Galileo thing.
Like that. No, obviously, you could see how this is a little dated, but I mean, obviously, the idea there is legitimate, but there's so many other avenues to it, like we were saying. Well, like, don't be eccentric just to be eccentric, though. Because we do see people who I think are more contrarians than skeptics.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
They take the eccentric or the out view just because that's the view.
Cynical contrarian.
Yeah. So the way I sort of summarize
people
that.
People who, like, commute to work on unicycles.
Yeah, right.
There's no need.
Oh, my God, there's this guy in Bethlehem.
Yeah, there's always one.
No. He's got, like, an Uber unicycle. So it's not just, like, a unicycle
like
this.
So, like, you can order it on the phone?
Yes, exactly. No, it's this. The wheel is, like, it's like an old-timey bike, but just the back, but just the front part. And, like.
So just the penny part of the penny fart.
Just the penny part of the penny fart. I don't even want to know. But the thing is, like, okay, you want to ride your unicycle. It's literally, the guy is, like, his seat is like this. And it's a unicycle. So he's going around town. But there is this look of like
smug
pride as he rides around with his ass sort of shaking.
Does he have a hippie beard?
No hippie beard, but he's dressed as if he's like he's cycling Tour de France. Uh-huh. So he's got like cycling gear.
Cycling gear.
Yes, helmet, the shoes.
Yeah.
You know, like.
You know what he needs? Awesome. Kicking the spokes.
And as you pass him, you know, as you're walking. And you pass him on the sidewalk.
Like a sheeple.
Is he heroic?
No, he gives you this look like, that's right. Here I go. Check it out.
Like he's
that's
figured
right.
it out.
Yeah. That's like, I'm going to go, dude. Like, you know, like Forrest Gump, like I'm going to follow this guy now on my own little crappy one-wheeled piece of shit.
That's what we call the urban attention seeker.
Oh, my God. It's UAS. Like the guy with, like a guy at a party with an iguana. And you gotta be like, all right, tell me about your iguana.
Ferret. I found most of them have ferrets or rats, but the iguana does come
so
up.
So you got a lizard on your shoulder, huh? Go ahead, tell me about it.
That? Yeah.
So George, you're saying like basically the unicycle does not get him laid.
Might. There's some...
Like, you think there's a unicycle woman out there that is, like, dying to meet the unicycle
Jay,
guy?
I used to work with a guy who was a clown with Barnum and Bailey. And he got so much crazy, like, clown fetish tail. Like,
I thought you were going to say something else.
It was like seltzer bottles. Like,
what did you think I was going to say?
Big pies in the face. Just pies. Yeah.
I like the idea that there was a crazier thing than women who are just obsessed with with clowns.
Like, what's clown foreplay like?
He described it to me, and it's not something that I could go into now.
Because you get in the back seat of his tiny little car?
Imagine he picks a date up in that tiny little car.
Yeah, right. Well, you could pick up
16
dates.
45 people come out. Yeah, right. 4 play, 8 play, 16 play, 24 play.
They have big feet, though, so.
You know what that means.
Do we squeeze every ounce of humor out of the clown sex? I don't know. I'm thinking.
This show will never end.
Or go to air.
Number 8.
Oh, yeah, right.
Find more pleasure in intelligent dissent than in passive agreement. For, if you value intelligence as you should, the former implies a deeper agreement than the latter. Find more pleasure in intelligent dissent than in passive agreement.
Yeah, I agree with that.
You know, echo chamber thing.
Yeah, have the balls to politely
disagree,
right? Don't agree for agreement's sake at the water cooler. You know, say if you don't agree and have a discussion about it.
I don't agree.
Back it up.
Yeah. I politely disagree.
You mean I'm wrong?
Oh, not going to get old. Somebody needs to tell me to stop because I'm not going to stop by myself.
Number 9.
Get me on that.
Tell Rebecca to stop.
even it's Uncle Bertie knew.
It's funny though, he says find more pleasure in intelligent dissent. Like, not just seek out, but like, realize that you learn more about your own position when you argue with someone that disagrees with you, especially when they're really good at it.
Yeah, I love arguing with people who disagree with me. I do. It's great.
Yeah. So we're all waiting for the
that double, was it.
So, yeah.
That's it.
Number
generally,
nine.
What Steve does with his time.
I used to. So, all right.
No.
People would, you said it. So people, especially when I lived in Baltimore. Anybody here from Baltimore?
Baltimore.
Baltimore, Maryland. It's a very special city. And
did you forget you were in Australia for a second?
Okay. I did.
Has
did,
anyone
right?
seen I
did.
The Wire?
I did. I forgot.
Yeah? Okay.
The Wire.
Yeah, they know what Baltimore is.
I lived in Baltimore where The Wire was filmed. And people would come around.
Can't you see it?
they would come around and they would want to argue with you about creationism on your doorstep. And I would for like hours. It was fun. I cut my teeth on door-to-door creationists. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was fun.
Nine. Be scrupulously truthful, even if the truth is inconvenient, for it is more inconvenient when you try to conceal it.
Absolutely.
So that's where Al Gore got the title. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Scrupulously truthful. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah.
And finally, number 10, do not feel envious of the happiness of those who live in a fool's paradise, for only a fool will think that it is happiness.
So could you guys add anything to that list?
All right. Well, yeah, what would be your 11th commandment?
Don't be a dick.
Read my mind.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Whatever Bertrand Russell's version of that would be in terms of like...
Yeah. Don't take pleasure in being a dick.
Take pleasure...
There's a bigger dick around that
one. Yes, yes. For it reveals how small your genitalia truly is.
And nobody wants to know that.
Okay. I think Bertrand Russell would have been down with that.
You think so?
Yeah, I don't think he would.
I would have liked to have seen something on the list that, unless I completely missed it, that says, you know, take pleasure in sharpening your mind. Like, educate yourself. Keep the pursuit of
I think the discourse
education.
One is kind of like that.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
You don't hear that name much anymore, Bertrand. You ever met someone named Bertrand?
Never. No.
Anyone?
Never.
Bert? No.
Usually it's from Albert, though.
Your dad's name is Bert?
No, good. Oh, Bert.
Russell? Is it just Bert?
Yeah.
No, Herbert. Herbert. Okay, Herbert. Herbert. Right. Herbert. Has anyone ever met an Adolf?
Yeah. My dad had a...
Adolf Kruger.
My
Adolf
dad had a plumber. That worked for him.
Oh, really?
His name was Adolf.
Adolf Kruger.
Who was a Nazi?
No, that was Mason.
That was his Mason was the Nazi. Seriously.
Yeah.
What was his name?
Clem.
Clem. Seriously, he was a...
Clem Schlossmeyer.
The Nazi.
Yeah, Clem the Nazi.
Mason?
He, listen to this, I have
Clem
a cool story.
Clem the Nazi Mason.
And my dad was at a card game with his Mason, and with a friend of his who was in World War II. Now, the Mason, Clem, was in World War II on the German side. This is the story.
This is the
story.
20 years,
20 years later, they're playing cards together.
So 20 years later, they're playing cards together. And
Goldfish!
Clem, like, very absentmindedly was, like, happily recollecting an awesome, like,
battle
that he was a pilot, and he basically was like describing sinking a boat.
Yeah.
And the guy that he was telling that to happened to be on a boat
that was
shot at. Not that it was the same thing.
But yeah.
Then that guy got wicked pissed off and then mentioned some battle where we kicked the Germans' ass. And then Clem got so pissed off he got up and left.
Did he salute before he left?
No. But like my dad described the story as like wicked hot and intense. Like these two fucking guys were like ready to go at it.
Now so masonry work? He would just do masonry work around the house?
And he would build chimneys, build stone walls,
Did they have any idea of until before this card game?
No, they knew. No, they'd never swapped stories before, though. That's too real.
And then they say, "See you next week."
Yeah.
Same time.
I don't know what happened after that. I'm sure that it didn't just evaporate right away.
Picture happy. Like, why do you hang out with somebody like that? Like,
the war
why?
Was over. He's a good Mason.
Oh.
What?
You know,
he was a really good Mason.
He's down with murdering an entire group of people, but
there's a big difference between an SS sergeant, and a guy that was in the army.
Yeah, he's a good German.
Yeah.
No, I get it.
A good German.
Isn't that the thing?
You just said after I said that.
Yeah, I always am astounded. Like at the end of the war.
Yeah.
The end of the war that like there is the delineation where German regular soldiers and American regular soldiers are trying to kill each other. They're trying to kill each other, like on Tuesday. And then on Wednesday, they're not. Yeah. Like, how do you deal with that? How do you mentally, like, no wonder these guys were just quiet and miserable for the next 50 years. You know what I mean? Like, how do you even approach that thing of like, we are trained to kill these people. Oh no, now they're fine.
Well, you're not even trained. Like, they were children.
Yeah. By the end, yeah.
The Germans were just children.
The majority of the German people didn't even agree with what the government was doing, what the military was doing.
Right.
So I'm sure a lot of the soldiers were probably not fully into the whole hype of the war.
Right.
And, you know, but I agree with you. It must have been incredibly emotionally destructive for
some people. It's like Slaughterhouse-Five, right?
Yeah, yeah, like, of course.
You know, it's like...
Which then makes me think, you know, then you watch Star Wars and you think like, okay, some of those stormtroopers, you know, that they're just doing it because they're just like, it's a gig. Yeah, you know.
You could find videos that illustrate that pretty easily, yeah. All right, so I had this news item here.
Yeah,
are we still doing a show?
This is a quick one. I thought this was interesting and you guys would enjoy it. So, some scientists decided that they were conducting an experiment on a Texas-49 rocket. And they, very late into their testing, they decided, hey, we're about to send this rocket up. Let's put DNA on it and see if the DNA can survive the trip into and out of the Earth's atmosphere and in its brief trip in outer space.
How'd they put the DNA on the rocket?
They essentially squirted it on the exterior.
They squirted the DNA on the rocket.
Rocket used.
Squirted how?
Heard a bird of
they said it was a murder.
They used a planchette.
Planchette?
Yeah. Right.
You can call it that.
Turkey baster.
A Ouija
Any
board planchette.
Come in.
First stage. Second stage. Third stage.
Blast off! So they used small double-stranded DNA molecules. And they applied.
Didn't use any of that triple-stranded DNA molecules.
Yeah.
I am taking information from an actual news item.
Go on. It says double-stranded right there.
It could be single-stranded. All right. All fairness, it could be single-stranded. Yeah.
This is we're punchy guys. So they applied it to the payload section of the rocket.
The hand motion that Jay just made resembled an ass. I don't know why.
They coated payload section of the rocket with the DNA material.
Yes.
Now, do you have a video of the money shot there?
So,
next news then.
Yeah. What happened when they shot the rocket off?
How'd it come out, Jay?
Did it spread all over the moon?
So they shipped the moon. After
did it go into Uranus?
Upon re-entry. Alright, so they tested the rocket after it re-entered the Earth's atmosphere. You know, I don't really know like if it was soft landing or whatever. But they found that the DNA was still there in all the places that they put it. So,
use like a black light or something.
Yeah, UV.
it's not getting any better, Jay.
It is hard to get rid of it once it's there. Yeah.
Especially if it's in your hair. Too far. Too far.
Someone had to see where that line was.
Yeah, no, I forgot that it was actually a double entendre. Single. Okay.
And what happened with the DNA, Jay? I'm like waiting.
All right. So all the places that they applied the DNA, they found samples of the DNA still on the ship. And then what they did was they took the DNA and they tested it, and they found that
it was DNA. Confirmed. Right, they tested it.
Yeah, they tested the DNA and they found that the DNA was able.
You're not the father. You don't watch Montel.
Bring us home, Jay. Bring us home.
Come on. I'm trying here. They found that the DNA could still transfer its genetic material to bacteria and to connective tissue. For some reason, they used connective tissue to test it. So
fibroblasts.
So what this essentially proves is that DNA can survive not only the environment in outer space, but it can survive the heat and everything that happens on reentry. So in essence, let's say that a huge meteorite hits a planet somewhere, ejects debris into outer space that has bacteria or from another planet. It can travel through space, and then it can enter a planet's atmosphere like Earth with all the overheating and everything that happens from the
panspermia.
Yep. So I find that to be this is essentially the first time that they proved that that DNA can do that. Which,
however, I mean, the one piece that they didn't test was surviving in outer space for thousands of years, which is what it would take.
Yeah.
So there you have the
cosmic radiation.
Yeah, the cosmic radiation, would that break it down over time? That's the hard thing. But if it were
protected by deep rock or
if it were deep in the meteor, then it could survive.
Some statistics that I found that were interesting. 100 tons of dust and meteorites hit the Earth every day.
Yeah.
So that's quite a bit of stuff coming in. So I was thinking, okay, so let's just extrapolate when we're thinking of panspermia idea. Maybe it didn't come on a meteorite. It could, you know, the bacteria could have been transferred from a spacecraft. Like they were actually saying that we can be contaminating Mars with our probes. And the moon and everything, you know, that our bacteria is up there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the Earth and Mars could have been cross-contaminating over billions of years. It's possible that life started on Mars and came to Earth.
Yep.
Or vice versa. Or was seeded to both planets from somewhere else. I mean, comets are frozen. They could have stuff in there that is seeding even from a previous generation star, right? There could be life from a previous solar system that seeded our entire solar system. It's all possible.
Yeah.
That's cool. All right. Well, it's interesting that DNA could survive, you know, the blast off and reentry. All right. Rebecca, I have no idea what this item is about. What I have written down here is Hong Kong pillows.
I'm sure I do.
I hope so. Hong Kong pillows.
Hong Kong pillows.
I was going to call it Hong Kong Fooey.
No.
And you objected to that.
She objected to that?
Well, you know, just.
Anybody know that reference, Hong Kong Fooey?
Hong Kong Fooey?
Yeah, three people.
More people here than in America, I think.
Yeah.
Who was the voice of Hong Kong Fooey?
Scatman
Crothers. Very
nice.
Good.
Whoa.
Yeah. He played a janitor, right?
So
is Hong Kong Fooey like racist or something?
No, I'm just saying that like I think most Americans have no idea what it is and would probably assume it's racist. Right. I don't know, I was just saying it's not. Whatever.
Right, all right.
Anyway, put whatever you want in the notes, Steve. I don't care. I recently arrived here in Australia from Hong Kong, and I loved it. You know, I hung out with the Hong Kong skeptics. We had a great time. David Young, who was on the show just, you know, a few weeks prior, was a fantastic host. I had a great time. He put us up in this beautiful hotel, and the hotel was so great. And then I noticed the first morning that I was there, they had a little card next to the bed, and it said that if you wanted, you could order any one of a dozen pillows, all of which were magical in some way. And so, like, this is like a seriously nice hotel. It's very westernized. Everyone speaks English, you know, but so it amused me to have this list of magical pillows. Some were things like, you know, it can help adjust your spine, for instance, which, yeah, sure. You know, the pillow that you use, the mattress that you lay on, that sort of stuff has an impact on your spine. But other of the pillows seem to have slightly more magical properties. So there were a few that had something called kapok in them, which, no, is not a Klingon food stuff. I know that's where you're all going already. K-A-P-O-K, I believe. And these claim to, by and large, be good for your liver. So if you've had a good night of drinking, you get the kapok pillow, and you lay on it for the evening.
Is it an herb or something?
Well, I was curious, so I looked it up, and it turns out that kapok is a cotton tree that's, you know, familiar to Asia. And it's often used, they create a seed oil out of it, kapok seed oil. So I and it's used in cooking sometimes and things like that. And so I.
So it is food.
It is occasionally used as food. Yes, but you are not to eat your pillow.
How do you eat cotton?
No.
Oil from the seed of the cotton.
Yeah, it's not cotton as you know it that your clothes are made of. Okay. It's a cotton tree, and then the cotton seed is turned into an oil. So it's a seed oil, you know. And so I looked up to see if there were any studies about the effects of this on the body, because I wanted to know where are they getting this, you know, this thing, this idea that kapok helps the liver. And all I could find were a few choice studies, one of which, the first of which I found, was done on chickens. And this was not on exclusively kapok seed oil, but kapok seed oil has a very specific type of fatty acid in it. And researchers took this fatty acid and fed it to chickens. And what they found was that the chickens had enlarged livers. After they took it.
Which, by the way, is not a good thing.
Yeah. Bigger is not better when it comes to your internal organs.
Well, organomegaly.
No, but they were eating the oil, but these pillows are just, have the essence of the
we'll
oil.
We'll get back to the pillows.
Okay.
Yeah, in this case, the chickens were not sleeping on pillows.
they had pillows?
Yeah, no. That would be adorable.
Yeah.
But no. They were actually consuming it. And also, the chickens stopped laying eggs. Also, generally not a great thing. There was another study that was done on rats in which at, when the, and then this specifically did use kapok seed oil. And when that oil consisted of approximately 30% of the rat's diet, the rat stopped normal, healthy growth. And around 60% of their diet, every rat died. They just died. So I couldn't find anything suggesting that kapok seed oil in any way help the liver, and all I could find were things that suggested that maybe it would be the opposite thing for your liver. But yeah, all that aside, it's in a pillow. Yeah. You're not eating your pillows, hopefully. Right. It occurred to me that the only way that I could conceivably take it into my body so that it would go through my liver.
Is it bite your pillow?
To either, I had a nightmare where there was a giant marshmallow and I ate it, and when I woke up, my pillow was gone, and it was kapok seed oil! Or if I had, run a hot bath and thrown the pillow in and made a nice tea.
Yeah.
That's it. But yeah, these pillows seem to be good for the business, so.
So that was one pillow, but they all have different weird things.
All of them had different things. There were several pillows that had kapok in them to help the liver, but then other things to help the kidney and stuff like that. Yeah, they were pretty much all complete BS. Yeah.
I'm shocked.
Yeah. So that was my main run-in with pseudoscience, specific to Hong Kong. There were other things, the standard ginkgo biloba and stuff that has since infected America to the point that it doesn't even really faze me.
I forget, did we talk about the eggs?
And yeah, the other thing was the eggs. Have we talked about it on this
year
yet?
I don't think we did the correction.
Let's do the fake thing.
Should we do that now?
Yeah,
let's do it now.
Oh my goodness. Sure? Okay, because this is great.
It's a great story. Cool.
So a few weeks ago we had on David Young of Hong Kong Skeptics, who was my host. And during Science or Fiction, we talked about this idea that there are these fake eggs in China and that they are sold in the markets, and it's a way for vendors to get more money. You know, they create these eggs that look just like real eggs, but they're not. And you can't even really tell when you crack them open. They look so much like real eggs that you can't quite tell. They might be a little more watery or something like that. And so we thought that was amazing. We talked a bit about it on the show and left it at that.
And everything, I looked it up online. Everything I found in English said that, yeah, they manufacture these fake eggs. They have equipment where you could make, one person could theoretically make 1,500 eggs in a day. They use some kind of material, plaster or something, calcium for the shell and some kind of resin for the egg part inside, and they just mass produce these fake chicken eggs, sell them as real, and they're cheaper to make than what the going price is for chicken eggs. So it's just a way of of making money off of fake eggs.
So that's the background.
They're not edible? They are edible.
They're, well.
Well, no, sort of, like the idea is like, they don't have the protein, they don't have like any of the benefits of the eggs, and they might be a little dangerous. Like, you shouldn't, you
but
probably
it's not sold like, quick, get out of here, like this is a plastic egg.
It's sold like as part of, this is the idea that they're sold like, there's a dozen eggs, but maybe only 9 of them are real eggs. Three of them hidden inside. Are these fake eggs that are just thrown in to pad things out and make more money. Fakes. Okay. That's amazing enough, right? Well, I'm going to give a talk in Hong Kong and then, and then I'm jumping over to mainland China where, an SGU listener named Daniel, was going to come and see me at the talk. And so Daniel decided as a special fun gift, he was going to find some fake eggs and bring them to me because as a resident, he had heard this story as well and thought that, oh, wouldn't that be fun since SGU just talked about it. So he sent his assistant out to pick some up. His assistant couldn't find any. So Daniel started digging into this and what he found was that fake eggs are fake. And in fact, fake eggs, in Daniel's opinion, which after looking at his research, I agree with him, fake eggs are a scam that are targeted at scammers. So if you want to scam people into buying your fake eggs, you can pay this scammer a lot of money to teach you how to make fake eggs. But then they don't because there's no such thing. They take your money and they run.
Oh, so someone is selling a fake, I'll show you how to make fake eggs thing.
Yeah. Right.
It's basically a bait and switch run.
So Daniel shows up at my talk and we're chatting about this.
Wow. Okay.
And there's a local, we were in, Dongguan, China, and a local was there who, wasn't a skeptic. There were a few skeptics there, or a few non-skeptics there because, they don't normally get English speaking talks there, so it's big news when someone comes through to give a talk. And so there was one Chinese local there, and Daniel and I were talking about this, and she was like, you're talking about fake eggs? And Daniel said, yeah, you know about fake eggs, right? She said, yeah, everybody knows about fake eggs. And he said, so you tell us about fake eggs. And she said, well, yeah, you know, you go to the market, you buy some eggs. Some of them might be fake. You got to be careful who you buy your eggs from. And he said, have you ever seen a fake egg? And she thinks about it and she says, well, no. And he said, does anybody you directly know, has anyone you directly know ever had a fake egg? And she said, well, no, but you know, my sister-in-law's cousin's brother, it happened to him. And he's like, so you've never seen this before in your life? She's like, no. And so he tells her what I just told you. And at the end of it, she was like, oh my God, you're right. There's no such thing as fake eggs.
Yeah. It's a typical urban legend. Friend of a friend.
Talk
everyone
about
knows.
A shell game.
Yeah.
And the thing is, like, when you look at it, it makes perfect sense because, like, that is so hard to make something that looks exactly like an egg.
I'm thinking, like, how would you do that?
Right.
Yeah, I was thinking, like, it can't possibly be easier to make or less expensive. It seems like a really difficult thing to fake.
Yeah. All you need is a chicken and some bits of seed. And actually, that was the other.
Again. Exactly. I thought we had an agreement.
That was. That's one other thing I want to say. Like my favorite moment, I think, when I was touring mainland China with the skeptics, we had a driver who didn't speak any English, but one of the skeptics did, and so he was doing the translating for us, and we were in this very poor farming village, and there were all these chickens running around. So I said, how do people know whose chicken is whose? Because the chickens are just running all around town, you know? And so there's the translation, and then our driver just laughs. And then he gives his answer, and I say, what did he say? And Michael says, well, he said that that's a really stupid question. And I said, please.
So some cab driver
please go
in
on.
China thinks you're stupid.
Not a cab driver, no, a driver. Like, when you, yeah, it's a whole thing. Anyway, he was an awesome guy. I loved him. We caught a frog together. We chased it through a farm and caught it. Anyway, we bonded.
Are you just making shit up now?
No, it was a magical experience. So he says, it's a really stupid question. And I said, well, then how do you know which chicken is whose? And he said, well, it's stupid because you know it's your chicken because you raised it. you know what your chicken looks like. That's number one.
Yeah.
Number two, your chicken knows who you are.
Wait,
because you raised it. So if you call your chicken comes to you.
Is that all true?
Absolutely, 100%
true. Like your chicken will come to you?
Yeah, chicken knows who you are. Maybe you raised that chicken.
Maybe that's why I know that for some reason I have here chicky chicky in my head. Like why? That's if no it. One says that, then why do I have that in my head?
Yeah, it's because you're
like George.
Because you're
I didn't just make that up.
You're a reincarnated poor Chinese farmer. That's right. Like that's why.
There's some genetic predisposition to having the hear chicky chicky in your head. Yeah. I think that's probably what it is.
I don't know, but I thought that was...
All right, so
I just love that. That's a
good story. No,
I like that this person at a skeptic organization was just like so not skeptical about fake eggs and just like,
we figured out that the fake story
is
awesome.
None of us were skeptical of it. Yeah. None of us. We were all like, wow, that's really interesting. Like, of course they would make fake eggs and sell them.
Well, it checked out. I mean, you have to go to Chinese sources to really see... That when you dig deep enough, no one,
and even
there's
then,
no direct, it's all an urban legend. Never.
That's really cool.
Like Chinese speakers don't know. Like, they just, they take it on as
the thing is, why is it so easy for, like, all of us to believe, oh yeah, fake eggs, no problem. But then when you think about it, it's like, yes, it would be so difficult to make a fake egg that would pass muster.
It's inexpensive. It's a great story.
Right?
It's
not just difficult. It's expensive. Steve, didn't somebody calculate what it would cost in material to create a fake egg? And it's so much more than just a real
buying
egg.
Chicken. Yeah.
Right.
It never was so cheap in China.
Yeah, there's... there is something about it that just, it grabs you,
That's what an urban legend is. Yeah. That's why urban legend
It's got the scam aspect. It's got a bit of a technology aspect. It's got the foreign land kind of thing of, oh, these people are so weird over there.
And then the real story is so much more fun, too, because, it's like, oh, the scammers are getting scammed,
Right.
Yeah, so thank you, Daniel, for doing that legwork, because it was
very
awesome.
Cool.
But I even wonder if the whole thing is a scam,
maybe
an urban legend.
In on it.
No, maybe the whole thing's an urban legend. Maybe there isn't any fake eggs or fake people faking about the fake eggs.
Right.
It's just the whole story is 100% urban legend. That wouldn't surprise me.
Oh, yeah. Instead of the fake people. Yeah, maybe.
Who knows?
I think we cracked this one wide open. I don't hear any of you trying anything. Okay?
Oh, I guess the yolk's on them.
All right, Bob. You're going to tell us how physicists discover new particles, new fundamental particles of the universe.
You hear about physicists discovering new particles all the time. In the news the past 6 months, it seems that there's been lots of new particles discovered. And I was thinking, well, how do they really discover new particles? I had an idea, but the level of detail, it was kind of interesting. So I looked at how the LHC, the Large Hadron Collider, how does it actually discover new particles? What are some of the details? We've all heard about, the huge pipes with the particles going through it, but really how does it work in a little bit more detail? So it starts with streaming hydrogen gas. They have to get the protons to smash together, so they're using hydrogen gas, and they put it into a duoplasmalatron, which strips off the electron, so you got just the proton. So that's their source right there. So that's what they're going to be working with. So then from then on, it's a matter of they need to accelerate it, then they need to collide them, and then they need to detect the particles. So a few more details. The acceleration is really complicated. There's like lots of layers of acceleration. They throw it into the LINAC-2, which is the first linear accelerator. They throw them in there. And they use electromagnetic fields to accelerate them to one-third the speed of light. So that's the first step.
Wow.
One-third the speed, which is damn fast, but they're just
fast.
Little protons, so it's not that impressive. But a third the speed of light. And then from there, they inject them into the proton synchrotron booster. Now, this consists of four rings. So they've got four rings in this booster. And they got, you got some protons here, you got some protons there. So what they want to do is they want to accelerate them so that they're all into like one big group, so that they can use
but
one group
the hell
of protons.
How do they even know that they're all in one group?
Yeah, it's all in the data. It's not like they're looking at a video of it happening, right? It's just too fast. But it's all in the data. They're looking at the numbers and they can tell that they're kind of synchronizing, I guess. So at this stage, they're at 91. This goes from 1/3 of the speed of light to 91.6% of the speed of light. So it's really getting up there. And the key thing here at this stage is that they're getting all close together. From there, they're injected into the proton synchrotron. And, so now they're in a concentrated group, and now they're being boosted to 99.9%. So they're really, that's pretty damn fast. 99.9% of the speed of light. So they're not gonna get it much faster than that. But it's gonna get more massive, because the closer you get to the speed of light, the more, you know, as you get really towards relativistic speeds, mass really increases. And that's what makes it impossible to hit the speed of light, because you would need infinite mass, you would need infinite energy, and that's just not gonna happen. But the thing is, so they want them to get heavier and heavier. So they're boosting it a little bit, just a little, but a tiny bit of a boost at that speed really can increase the mass a lot, right? It's gonna just go way up. And then from there, they go into the super proton synchrotron, and that is where they accelerate it. This is the 4-mile ring, and they accelerate it just a little bit more, but it really makes them really massive. And you want them massive because then when they collide, the more mass, you can have many more particles being created from that mass that's generated from the acceleration from the velocity. Okay. So then from there, they inject them into the primary, these are the primary beam pipes at the LHC. And, this is where the protons are going in opposite directions. And on four sides of these vacuum tubes, they've got the detectors, and these are critical. That's how they know what happens once they collide. Cause in these four sections, the beams cross, and then that's where all the magic happens. And, alright.
I thought they said not to cross the beams.
except at the detector chamber. So, okay.
So someone had fun naming all of these, the synchrotron. Well, the super proton synchrotron. The detector chamber.
You've got these detector chambers. Now, some of these detector chambers contain tracking devices.
It's detector or detecto?
Detector.
Oh, I thought you said detector.
Detecto? No, Jay. They're not that
you
silly.
Can probably send an email to somebody, Jay, get that changed. I agree with you. It should be detector.
So some of these detector chambers have tracking devices, and that's where they actually can see the path. They can visually see some of the paths that these particles are taking.
But in order for them to detect those particles, though, doesn't something have to interact with those particles? Like, what's interacting with them? Is it the disturbance of the magnetic?
Okay. Good timing, Jay, because right here, I was trying to reword what they're saying this, so I'm just going to go with a quote. This is from How Stuff Works, which had a great overview of how all this stuff works. So this is what happens at this point. As the particles move through the tracking devices, electrical signals are recorded and then translated to a computer model. Calorimeter detectors also stop and absorb a particle to measure its energy, and radiation is also used to further measure its energy and mass, okay? Thus narrowing down the particular particle's identity. So that's kind of the crux of it right there. So the other big problem is that you've got billions and billions of collisions. How do they possibly know which ones are interesting and which ones are not interesting? Because the vast majority are just boring particles that they've seen a million times. Nothing new to learn there. A very tiny, tiny subset. So what they do is, somehow in these detectors, the detectors can spot something that's interesting. And when they think they found something that could be interesting, they run it through an algorithm and then could give it a red flag, which tells the physicist, all right, you got to check this one out in detail because this could contain something interesting. And I assume that's one of the ways that Higgs was discovered, that they were flagged, that they can go in and look in really incredible detail. And that's pretty much it. That's how they discover the particles. Now, in 2015, the LHC is going to be superpowered. It's going to be twice, you know, many, many more collisions. And apparently the software that spots the interesting collisions are going to be like version whatever, a new version that's more powerful. So maybe we'll see some really interesting stuff in 2015. So that's basically it.
That's really cool.
Very basically.
I didn't know any of that. I had a very vague understanding.
Of course, I'm just so scratching the surface. Yeah. It's ridiculous. It's just so, can you
one thing I remember.
Detailed
yeah,
it?
One thing I remember that from that Bob is that they will expose the particles to a magnetic field, and then when they come out in the detector, they see if the particles are changing their pathway in response to the magnetic field.
Right.
And that way they'll know if it's a charged particle.
Right.
So it's how they know if the particle has and how much charge. Right. because the more charged, the more it will respond to the magnetic field.
Right.
So that's just one way to figure out one property of the particles, and they have other methods.
Right.
For,
and obviously magnets are incredibly important for this entire process.
Cool. All right. Okay. We're going to talk about another, this is going to be a quick one, but we're going to talk about something else that's cool that we'd like to talk about on the SGU, and that is graphene. Right? Is everybody know what graphene is?
Yes. Yay.
The graphene is a one molecule thick, form of carbon. Essentially, the carbon atoms are arranged like a chicken wire fence.
So it's an allotrope of carbon.
An allotrope, thank you. And it has some incredible properties. It is very strong. It's 10 times stronger than steel. It's highly conductive. This one molecule layer thick, sheet, essentially. And it can be, theoretically used for a lot of purposes. The real limiting factor for it has been the ability to manufacture it in large amounts and at high quality. So, meaning with the fewest numbers of imperfections, like a bond out of place. You mentioned this perfect, chicken wire fence, but if, you could have bonds that are broken or that are just the wrong way or kinked or whatever, and it doesn't, that interferes with its properties. So mass producing it with high quality, very few, these errors in it is, that's the limiting factor. But still, at the research level, researchers are finding all kinds of interesting things about it. What this study showed, this wasn't surprising, but it's cool, is they took, the sheets of graphene between 10 and 100 layers thick. Still, 100 molecules thick, that's still really thin.
Is that even visible?
Yeah, I think so. It'd be like a little, like a very thin
like a film,
little
almost,
film. Yeah. So, and then they shot these little tiny silica beads at it, almost like a microscopic BB gun. And then they examined, so they basically were shooting little tiny bullets through these very thin sheets of graphene. And then they were looking at it under an electron microscope to see what happened. What they discovered was that the graphene is really good at dissipating the energy of the impacts. That if you imagine, these little micro bullets would hit the sheet, it would sort of depress the sheet in like a cone-like shape, and then it may penetrate through, but it would sort of crack the graphene in a pretty wide distribution. So a lot of the energy would get distributed over a very large section of the graphene. They were doing this to see if graphene had properties that would make it a good material for armor. Would this be a good armor against penetrating weapons? And what they found was that the graphene was able to absorb 8 to 10 times the energy of steel. So,
wow.
Yeah, it would.
About 100 molecules thick, basically.
Yeah. So, but if you made it like thick body armor out of it, it's like you're wearing super steel, but it's this flexible fabric,
so you extrapolate that out. Wow.
Yeah.
You've got something. Now, is that really see-through? Significant.
No, that not at that thickness. However, they said that. What am I missing?
Jay snorted.
Oh, he made himself snort.
Okay, all right.
See-through police vests. This police force with nipples exposed.
All right, there's one disadvantage, though, is that when it did penetrate, it made a much bigger hole. Yeah, it made a bigger hole.
Wait, that's a huge disadvantage.
Yeah.
So it's really good at dissipating energy, but it kind of can break apart in a widespread way. That's kind of the price you pay for it. However, they may be able to combine it with other materials.
It's a coating.
Yeah, so you have different layers. One layer with the good at dissipating energy, another layer that's good at resisting penetration, whatever. And that the combination of the properties could make really super armor. Just one more way in which graphene is going to change our lives.
So when the hell are they going to make this? When's this going
to
get rolled out?
5 to 10 years.
It's like all this cool stuff we still can't do with it because we can't mass produce it yet. All right, Evan, how come I can't convince those creationists on my stoop in Baltimore to believe in evolution?
Well, according to one study, it's because they just don't care.
Okay.
A new report by Calvin College Assistant Professor Jonathan Hill reveals that many Americans do not think that it's important to have the correct beliefs, quotation marks, on the origins of human life. He says that it's important to know that a large portion of the population is, two things, unsure about their beliefs, and an even larger portion of the population just doesn't care. Here's how his study broke down. It was a survey, about 3,000 people, and they were divided into four categories. Creationists, atheistic evolutionists, theistic evolutionists, and unsure. And here's how it broke down. 37% of the population are creationists. 16% accept the scientific evidence for evolution while still believing God was involved in creation in some way. 9% embrace evolution and reject God. That's the atheists, okay? Which leaves 38% unsure. But of all those, of all 100% of those, 58% of the respondents said that the topic was only somewhat, not very, or not at all important to them.
But I'm not clear on what that specifically means. Like, they just don't care what the truth is?
That's essentially right.
They have no opinion either way, or they really just have no emotional interest whatsoever.
It's probably a combination of certain things. But the group that was most passionate, certainly, if you can guess, the creationists, 64% of them said that they care about being right on the issue. But as he observed, he said that still leaves 36% of creationists don't care about being right. Yeah. And it even gets worse, and the apathy was much stronger among the other groups.
Wow.
So what does that tell us?
What was the apathy?
The point that he's making is you can't, it's very difficult, it's very challenging to educate people into believing in evolution. So that's what he believes the findings of this study reveals. And I don't know that I necessarily agree with that. Now, here's a bit of information you also need to know. His research was funded by the BioLogos Foundation, pro-evolution Christian organization founded by National Institute of Health director Francis Collins.
So what do you think that means?
Well, I don't know. Steve, what you've had some dealings with.
Collins is great.
Francis Collins.
I mean, yeah. I think he does a great job of talking to other Christians. Like, he's a Catholic, I think.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. He does a really good job of being like, hey, you don't have to be atheist in order to believe in evolution. I think it's critical.
Okay. Is he saying that, like, our efforts are basically being wasted? You know, we're only affecting, what, 42% of people when we're, you know, trying to do the work that we're trying to do?
That's actually pretty good. 42%. I mean, we go for much less than that.
More than
I mean,
that.
I do. I mean, I've encountered all types. Yeah, I think I've personally encountered people all over that survey. Specifically, I definitely have spoken to people about, like, creation versus evolution who have said things to the effect that they don't care what the science says. They don't care what the facts are. They have their belief. And even, like, so what are you concerned that maybe your belief might be wrong? I said, I don't care. This is my belief. I'm comfortable with it.
Yeah. It's a matter of comfort.
You know, it certainly seemed to me like they were just trying to avoid anything that would challenge their comforting beliefs. And they couldn't even muster a justification for it. And so their fallback was, well, I just don't care about being right. I just want to have this belief. But, of course, other people insist that they're right. You know, they say the evolution is dumb. Yeah, but some people, you know, like that are very passionate about believing that evolutionists are dumb, you know, and that creationism is the only rational thing to believe in. They're just massively misinformed, systematically massively misinformed, but they care about being right. At least they say that they do. You still wonder, like, if you really cared, I think you would be a little bit more aggressive in seeking what the scientific consensus is, but, you know, I don't know. I do think, I mean, there are some people who are just so massively misinformed that I see them as victims of this system of misinformation.
Isn't it the framing of the question, though, too?
Yeah,
I mean,
on surveys?
And this one in particular. I mean, as soon as you address it through the context of evolution versus non-evolution or religion versus non-religion, you're going to get sort of a response, I think, you know, sort of a knee-jerk response. You know, if the question were, are you interested in knowing the origins of life?
Yeah.
I think most people would say yes. Like, it seems to be conflating the issues. Like, this is more about, are you comfortable in your beliefs?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you not want to know how things really work?
Yeah, and the way you phrase a question can dramatically change.
Yeah, you know?
It's almost, you know, a question, the way that they were quizzed, because it could be biased towards the answer too much. Yeah, I agree with you, George. Yeah. I have to know more about the actual thing. But it is interesting, though. I mean, I'm sitting here thinking, wow, could I? It's so hard for me to not have an opinion on almost anything. Like, seriously, let alone something so incredibly important as evolution, like that, you know, origin of the species, whatever. Like, does it exist? Does it not exist?
What is more important to them? Yeah, what's the thing they're going to say that I would rather think about this than that?
So. But remember, some people think that faith is a virtue. Wrap your head around that.
Most,
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I mean, I'm just saying that maybe we get so used to being science enthusiasts and skeptics, we forget. Some people think faith is a virtue, meaning believing something.
The entire civilization. faith is a virtue. It's got its own little saying.
Most of us are like one click away, like our parents and our parents' parents, like that close to us. Yeah, you know, my wife was just telling me about her grandmother and how, like, you know, like you just said, like the whole faith is a virtue thing. Yeah. She was telling me a story about how her grandmother was saying, you know, you just have to have faith in God and let that sink way down into your psyche.
Yeah, I've had people say, like, well, but there's absolutely no evidence for God. That's what makes it so beautiful.
Yeah.
Right? The faith is even more profound because there's absolutely no reason to have it. There's no evidence. There's no logic. So just a complete flip of the whole notion.
I don't think that people that have this incredibly strong faith would say that there's no evidence. I think they find evidence in the minutiae, in little things.
It's a definitional sort of conflict that's there. Yeah, the definition of faith is belief in something without evidence. But most folks will, if you ask if someone has faith in something, they will tell you reasons why.
Yeah.
You know, right. In the same way that a scientist or a non-believer will be just as vehement saying, like, there's no evidence for it, and here's why there's no evidence for it. You know, they will say, no, I see God everywhere. You know, all the time. I always talk about the opposite of the differentiation between faith and trust. Like, I don't have faith that the sun will come up tomorrow. Like, I trust the sun will come up tomorrow because it's come up every day so far. Yeah. I trust my parents love me because they've shown me that they love me and that they would support me. Or I trust that my friends are, you know, I have faith in nothing. And like, that to me is a virtue. Like,
You have historical evidence that things are going,
All right. Got two more things ahead. We're going to end with science or fiction, but before that, we have a bit. We're going to talk about, and we don't have to spend too much time on this, but we're going to go down. Everyone's going to say what thing in what media outlet, could be an author, a movie, anything, doesn't have to have been the first one, but it could be, had a profound effect or was a milestone in your journey towards skepticism. Which end do we want to start with? George, was your idea?
I'll start. There were two things. I just talked about this the other day. The first one actually is Mr. Rogers.
Mm-hmm.
Watching Mr. Rogers as a kid, there was this sort of safety, and the fact that he spoke directly to the camera and wasn't a character, he was sort of this, I mean, Mr. Rogers, right? Everybody, that's an Australian, not an Australian thing, but you're aware of Mr. Rogers? Oh, you're not? Okay. Mr. Rogers, was
a
Fred Rogers.
It's a beautiful day in the neighborhood.
That's not gonna help.
No? Is that ringing? I got some nods.
Keep going. Fred Rogers was early public broadcasting in America. Channel 13, Sesame Street, early PBS. He was sort of very instrumental in providing children a sort of safe haven on TV. A gentle place where kids could... He would do songs like, you'll never go down the drain. I remember that as a kid. That this was like this fear of children. Like, you know, I can't go in the shower because I'm going to fall down. You're much too big to fall down. God, I want to like tear up. I'm just thinking about it right now. It's amazing. Aww. You're much too big to go down the drain. My nephew, like, we couldn't figure out why my nephew wouldn't pee in front of the toilet. And then we figured, oh, he's afraid he's going to get sucked into the toilet.
That's adorable.
Yeah, it was adorable. And it's like we had to explain, like, no, you're too big. You can't. It's fine. Like, he could pee outside by a tree. Like, no problem. We're like, why isn't it? What? Oh, he's just scared he's going to go down the drain.
I mean, it could happen on an airplane. I'm just
Should I call him now and just warn him?
Let him know.
Anyway, regardless, Mr. Rogers was very gentle. He's made fun of a lot and whatever, but boy, he testified in front of Congress, I remember.
Yeah.
Like, even as a kid, I remember that there was this guy talking to, like, government officials about the importance of a smart one-on-one communication with kids, not talking down to them and appreciating them. So that was a big influence on me. The second one, which I didn't even realize until years later, that this was a sort of a hidden atheistic, contrarian humor character that was sort of anti-establishment, but questioned everything, was Hawkeye on MASH.
Sure. Yeah, you know?
That's watching MASH as a kid, and just, there was something, I mean, he was like this Groucho Marx kind of character, but really competent. You know, he was a fantastic doctor. What he did really well. He was kind of humble about it. He knew he was good, but just called bullshit whenever he saw it.
That shows you how much of an influence Alan Alda had on his character. Because he is a dyed-in-the-wool skeptic.
Still a flawed character. I mean, he definitely alcoholic. Had flaws. Alcoholic, womanizer.
Womanizer, right, sure. But that was, I remember that being the first thing of like, oh, I kind of want to be like that. Like, to know what to say, to be able to argue, you know, and call out authority just because it's authority.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, those two.
Yeah, that character is very skeptical when you think about it. Yeah.
Yeah. Why are we doing this? No, I'm not going to salute you. I'm not going to salute you. That's meaningless. You
know? And he's very passive aggressive. Because he's in the army. You know, there's only so much he could do.
Right.
So he found a way to be passive aggressive about everything in a very entertaining way. Right. It actually was, wonderful.
Biting sarcasm. I mean, even before, you know, The Simpsons came along, which taught us all about sarcasm, it was Hawkeye Pierce who first taught me about sarcasm and humor.
Right.
Very much so.
Do you have another character or outlet or author or movie?
As I mentioned the other day to you, it's kind of the prime example, Scooby-Doo. But if you're looking for another one, it would have been certainly Spock from Star Trek, because I never had a course in critical thinking or logic, even right through college, unfortunately. But in thinking back on it, it was Spock who really, you know, brought up and drove home the whole point about logic. And even though sometimes he was talking about logic, but maybe it wasn't like good examples that he was bringing up in regards to logic, he got you to stop and think about certain things in sort of a different way, and to, you know, challenge your own beliefs in a certain sense from the point of being a human with the limitations that a human has. And what you need to do is stop, remove yourself from your humanness, and take a look from more of an objective standpoint as to what you're saying and how you're acting.
Yeah. Wow, that's really cool. I wouldn't have even thought of Spock, but you're so freaking right. Like, it was that whole Vulcan perspective that was introduced, and it kind of sunk in a little bit. We used to call Steve the Vulcan when we were kids. And I'm not kidding.
Used to.
I don't know why.
And then and Roddenberry was, in the context of Spock, was brilliant in that he made him half human. Because, you know, that obviously
bridging the gap.
More depth to the character and his own conflicts that he also had to deal with.
We're all half human and half Vulcan.
Well, sort of.
Struggling with our logical and our emotional side.
I mean, that's
a metaphor for humanity.
It sort of is, but, you know,
I think it's true. The whole Star Trek franchise itself is a great, in a way, sort of scientific skeptical lesson in that it's one of the few science fiction outlets that has a very bright utopian kind of future as opposed to a dystopian or dark kind of future. But also, there was some implicit culture in the Star Trek universe. And the one thing that I totally keyed into, I think we all did, was a respect for hard work and excellence, right? You got ahead in the Star Trek universe by being good at what you did. Scotty was badass.
Meritocracy.
Because he was a meritocracy, but he was badass because he was such a damn good engineer. He was knowledgeable. And he was nerdy. You remember how nerdy he was? Remember in Trouble with Tribbles?
Yeah.
When Kirk confines him to his quarters as a punishment, he's like, ooh, I can catch up on my technical journals. And that was, he was all excited about that. They totally captured.
I totally remember that line. And then all those tribbles were there, and it's like, whoa, tribbles!
No, seriously, I mean, for a young kid, I mean, we were like at that perfect impressionable age, which is why we still talk about Star Trek, you know, so many years later. We're at a very impressionable age. They were great role models, you know, modeling the whole thing. Oh yeah, like if you're smart and work at things and have knowledge, then you fit in the world. You know, it was great.
And certainly in the absence of being, you know, taught logic or critical thinking in any sort of course setting, you know, Spock was a really good teacher of those things for me.
Starfleet was a really interesting organization like Steve made me think, like, you really do look up, like, to be in Starfleet, you have to be exceptional. Yeah. And there's really no slackers in Star Trek. that like those hippie characters don't exist. Like you just have aggressive, intelligent.
Well, except in that one episode.
Yeah. Except for like those entire planets of hippies where it's the hippie planet.
I can sing the song from that episode, by the way. Coming home to Eden, yeah, brother. Remember that shit?
Yeah. And then all those tribbles came out. I was like, whoa, tribbles. That was a crazy
episode. Wait, she's full of shit. She never watched Star Trek.
Not in that episode.
He totally figured you out.
Busted. God damn it.
So they were like, warp speed. Whoa.
Holy shit.
God,
we're no man.
Oh, no. The Bjork is here.
Bjork is a
Bjork. All right.
Well, my biggest influence.
Relax.
We had to be the original Cosmos series.
Yeah.
That was the first thing that Carl Sagan like grabbed me so strongly and made me love the idea that science is there, it's accessible, it's a tool, it's wonderful. He just totally blew my mind as a kid. And these guys, I'm listening to my older brothers talk about Carl Sagan in a way that I couldn't even really get it. You know, I'm 4 years younger than these guys. That's quite a bit younger. But just having them get excited about it got me excited about it. And we would just be talking about Cosmos and Carl Sagan and going over those episodes over and over again.
I was going to say Mad Magazine. All right. Yeah, that was my first, like, introduction to, like criticizing the things you love and tearing them to shreds and still loving the things you love
and
loving
authority.
Them even more. Criticizing authority. Yeah, not listening to what adults are sometimes dumb and it's fun to make fun of them. Like, yeah, critical.
I was just picturing, I just remember in Cosmos, sorry to jump back one, but in Cosmos, there's a sequence where he's walking through the library of Alexandria, the lost library, and Carl is sort of saying like, oh, you know, to read these, and he's holding up a book, it's a scroll, you know, holding up a scroll to read these ancient writings that were lost. And as a kid, I remember like, pining for these books that I had no idea what they were. But I was like, oh, damn, they're gone. Like, oh, man. And that's purely Sagan's influence of saying, like, here's something that, you know, knowledge is gone, and that sucks. You know, we'll have to make up for it.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious. And you get to try to guess which one is the fake. We have a theme this week.
Say it, Rebecca.
The theme is fossils. Fossils.
Okay.
I'm going to read the three items, and we're going to take a little survey of our in-studio audience. Then we'll get our expert opinion on the panel. We'll once again see what influence we had. And then I'll do the reveal. Got it?
Yep,
good. Okay, here we go. Yep, okay, here we go. That was for their benefit.
You wouldn't know.
Yeah. Item number one. Zibit. Item number one. Scientists report the discovery of spherical multicellular fossils that are 600 million years old and may be the oldest animal fossils. Item number two. In 2003, paleontologists discovered a fossilized frog they named Beelzebufo, which was 80 centimeters, or 32 inches long, and completely covered in spiked bony armor.
Awesome.
And item number three, scientists have discovered an amber fossil of a 100 million year old spider caught in the act of attacking a wasp. Okay, so we got the 600 million year old multicellular spheres, the armored frog, or the amber with a spider catching a wasp. For in the audience, if you think the spheres are the fiction, applaud. If you think Beelzebufo the frog is the fiction, applaud. And if you think the spider and the wasp are the fiction, then applaud. Okay, that's a pretty good distribution.
Two and three, seems like.
Yeah, two and three are close. One is trailing a little bit. George, do you mind going first? We'll start down there.
I think the sphere is the fiction. I think the 600 million year sphere is the fiction. A frog sounds cool. Spider sounds cool.
Okay.
Can't argue with that.
Based on pure coolness.
Coolness. Based on coolness. Okay. Evan?
Yeah, all right. I think the spear one is correct. It's between the frog and the spider attacking a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant here. So that one leads me to believe that, you know, that really didn't happen.
Ooh, bitten in there.
Spiders are all over me.
You killed the spider, Lovey. So, Gilligan's Island reference.
Yeah, no, I just feel like it's weird that that's what everybody has decided the quintessential wasp is the millionaire from
Mr.
Gilligan's
Howell's,
Island.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's just weird to me.
What would be your wasp voice?
We all just decided.
I'll say the frog armor one. There's some recollection I have about the amber 100 million year one, but I'm not sure. But so, the frog one I've never heard before. I'll say that's the pick.
The frog. Okay. Rebecca.
Yeah, it's frog.
Yeah, at first I was thinking the amber one wouldn't work because amber is slow and stuff. But, like, maybe they were distracted fighting each other.
Like tribbles falling out of this.
Yeah. Like, exactly like tribbles. No, nothing like tribbles. They don't get distracted. What are you, a noob? Casual.
What are you, a bork?
Star Trek pure casual. I don't know what George said.
The spheres?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jay.
So tired.
I want to go out on a limb here. I think they're saying that it was 600 million years ago that the spider was attacking the wasp.
No, that was 100 million.
100 million years ago. I'm going to pick that one as the fiction because I'm not sure that either of them even existed 100 million years
okay.
ago.
Okay. Bob?
Interesting point. I think I'm going to go with the, I've got a memory of the first multicellular organisms being more flat sheets, not anything really three-dimensional like that. And that seems really old to me. And how would they fossilize? I mean, I'm not sure how well they would fossilize if they were just cells with no hard parts. That makes it even less likely, not impossible. So I'm going to go with that one.
Okay, so we had three spheres.
G-R-B.
Frog
and the spider.
Spider and wasp.
Yeah.
It's a good distribution.
The...
Let's see if you, quickly, if you influence the audience. Now, how many of you think that the spheres are the fiction?
We were not compelling.
The frog is the fiction. And the spider is the fiction. You had no influence.
Zero.
No, we did. People in the back clapped mine.
Okay. All right. So, let's take these in order.
Wait, what does that mean?
Number one.
It means we're wrong.
Scientists report the discovery of spherical multicellular fossils that are 600 million years old and may be the oldest animal fossils. Some of our panelists think this one is the fiction. And this one is science.
Yes.
Good job, audience.
Crap.
So yeah, these are surprising. These were discovered in China. They're very small.
Are you sure they're not fake?
They're spheres.
It's like a, you just set me up.
Yeah.
Rebecca, you were going there too. I saw you go.
Yeah, that's what he's doing. He's going to tell another great tribble story.
So they're not sure exactly what these are because this is right on the cusp of the evolution of multicellular animals. It could be embryos of a multicellular animal. Because when I saw the picture of them, that's what it looks like. It looks like a cluster of cells in a sphere, which looks like a really early blastocyst or whatever you would call it, embryo. So that's possible.
Baby.
It could be multicellular, but not an animal. It could be like a fungal colony or something. So not sure what they are, because they're fossilized, you know. But that's very cool. 600 million years old. That's old. Okay, we'll go on to number two. In 2003, paleontologists discovered a fossilized frog they named Beelzebufo, which was 80 centimeters, 32 inches long, and completely covered in spiked bony armor. An armored frog. About half the audience thinks this one is fiction. Evan, you think this one is a fiction?
Fiction.
And this one is... the fiction.
Oh. All hail the hypnotoad.
Now, Beelzebufo is a fossilized frog that's large. It's half the size that I said, though. It's only 40 centimeters. And it's not covered in armor. They're completely covered in bony armor. An armored giant frog.
Why is it called Beelzebufo?
They call it Lord of the Flies.
Basso
right?
is flies?
No, Beelzebub is Lord of the Flies.
Right.
So the frog is Lord of the Flies because he's the biggest frog ever.
What's Buffo?
I don't know. That's what they that's the Beelzebub.
It has no clothes on.
That's a great name. That's a great name for an
it
animal.
Is a great name.
Beelzebub because he's Lord of the Flies. He's the big frog. I mean, come
I
on.
Just don't know where Buffo comes from.
I don't know.
From.
I don't know. All right. And number three, that means scientists have discovered an amber fossil of a 100-million-year-old spider caught in the act of attacking a wasp is science. Isn't that cool?
Yay!
The wasp was caught in its web,
and
he was descending upon it to kill it, and then they must have just got covered in tree sap right at that moment.
You know, that
the spider's like...
That wasp was like, oh, shit.
They also found a male spider caught in the same web. Which is the first evidence, you know, it's not proof, but it's evidence for the behavior of spiders from 100 million years ago, because sometimes, you know, the females will eat the male spiders, and they think that that's probably what was going on there. Mm. Right?
So, very you know, complicated they, shit going on, spider.
It's very,
running, man.
The tree sap caught some nasty shit going on there. Caught the whole web and the female spider killing a wasp and had the male trapped over there. We're going to eat them later.
Telenovela.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking more like a Big Brother.
So Evan won.
Style,
Evan,
the sole survivor.
And this was the last science or fiction of 2014.
Way to bring it home. Thank you, Arthur.
Good job, Evan.
Jay, give us a quote.
This quote, all the quotes that I'm using on this trip were supplied to me by our friend Fred Bremer.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Oh,
yeah. I asked him to help me.
The second tallest skeptic in the world.
Yep. And this is a quote by Bertrand Russell, and the quote is, the whole problem with the world is that fools and fanatics are always so certain of themselves and wiser people so full of doubts.
So true.
Very wise. Based on a Shakespeare quote, the fool doth think he is wise, but the wise man knows himself to be a fool.
Wow. Steve, would you yell the quote with me for once? Never done it together.
Sure.
Right on three. Ready? One, two, three. Bertrand Russell!
All right. Thank you all for joining us. Thank you, George.
You're
lovely
welcome.
To have
Thank
you as
you.
Always.
Thank you. Always
Steve.
Fun.
We are surviving. Yeah. We're about halfway through our Australia-New Zealand tour. We're surviving.
Oh, yeah.
And until next week, actually the next show, I think after this one airs, is going to be our year-end wrap-up episode. That should be fun. So until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.